The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Hello there, and a very good morning to you. You're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. More or less, looking across the papers, there's a John Joe Nevin story, there's the GAA, and there's Alan Shatter and all the stuff associated with that. But let me start with the Sunday Times. Gardaí discussed cash for testimony. That's to do with the Bailey case. Kenny has to repay $7,400 in expenses, as indeed did a lot of people who got paid their expenses up front and didn't use them. And they have another story which might amuse, which is the censors pore over children's saint book. And we had all kind of half forgotten about the censorship of publications. But anyway, somebody appears to be sending the whole thing up because they have sent off a copy of the life story of St. Anthony of Padua, which was written for children. Anyway, it's gone to the censors. Doctors protest in Dublin against free GP care for children, and Martin McGuinn is set to dine with Queen. The Sunday Independent cracks in Shatter's statement on tapes. Probe into sale of PPS numbers, and forget about public A&E, head to the Black Rock or the Beacon. The Sunday Business Post, exclusive new revenue clampdown on contract workers, self-employed told to pay up or face immediate demands, and ministers are told, sorry about this folks, ministers are told to prepare for a fresh round of cuts. Ministers are required to begin the process of identifying further cuts. Was drawn after discussion. All copies of the documents were collected. That's to do with documents that appeared at the cabinet, we are told. Now, the Mail leads with a story about Frank Flannery and Angela Cairns. The Sunday World is leading with the story about the boxer John Joe Nevin. As I say, he got a lot of coverage. You know, he won a silver medal in the London Olympics. And the headline says, Nevin's leg bust up in golf club horror. The Sunday Mirror leads with the same story. John Joe's leg smashed in street brawl. And the Irish Sun on Sunday has a bit of glamour because they're referring to Michael Fassbender and all that went with last night, so to speak, and suggests there might be something with Naomi Campbell, even model Naomi, on date with Irish actor. Right. Let me introduce our guests to you this morning. With us in studio are Peter McKenna, Commercial and Stadium Director with the GAA, Fiona Looney, Mail on Sunday columnist, playwright and creator of Celebrity Bonishtore, Mary Hannafin, former Fianna Fáil Minister for Education, Declan Power, Security Analyst, and Mick O'Keefe, MD of Pembroke Communications and ex-Dublin footballer. And as I said to you at the outset, there is an awful lot about the GAA and that deal in the papers today. And I have, thanks be to goodness, Peter McKenna, you did the deal.
Yeah, good morning, Marianne.
Good morning to you.
How are things?
Yeah. They're good, they're good. Tell us what happened.
What we were looking to do is to create a global strategy for our games. Lots of times when we were abroad, the real message coming back was that people in England, in Australia in particular, and in the US couldn't get access to our games. So what we wanted to do was make that access available. And so we the first foray into this is to moving with Sky. Sky will take 14 matches this
year. How much debate went on about that?
We've been talking about this for about 9 months. Yeah. So
heatedly?
No, not really. I mean, I think we all seen that this was something that would be to the benefit of the games and the benefit of getting our signal out. Some of the things that we were looking at, Marianne, would be changes in technology. RTE have high definition broadcast facilities. So does Sky. That wasn't true of all of the people that are looking at it. We also wanted a 32 county distribution. So Sky and RTE can both do that. What Sky brings us in the UK market is access to 10, 11 million households that will really bring our game to a new level there.
Yeah, and what I'm curious to know is, because, I mean, the GAA has changed its policy on a whole heap of things, from the ban to the foreign games and all that kind of thing down through the years. There must have been some heated discussion. Somebody must have said, listen, they'll go bananas if we do this. Was there no such debate behind the scenes, like?
Well, I mean, the rancour wasn't there. I mean, I think we see ourselves as having obligations to GAA fans. There's over 500 clubs set up worldwide. Many of those where Irish people are immigrating to currently, like places in China, Shanghai and so forth. And our Asian Games there, when we held them in Shanghai this year. Again, the big reaction is we can't get access to the games. How do we do that? Now, I think in the
but
deal...
But haven't you also given RTE, or sold, I presume, RTE the rights to stream worldwide?
Yeah, that's a joint venture that we're going to. We're really looking forward to doing that with your colleagues in RTE Digital, and so that's a very, very exciting part of the whole development. So jointly, we will work together to stream matches right across the States, across Europe, across Africa, across Asia, and in Australia, we've done a deal with Seven, which will bring us to 87% of Australian households.
What has me slightly confused is, I mean, I can see commercial value in the thing, but if you can get it online, why do you need to go to Sky?
I think the pattern and any of the research would say is that the most important thing is to broadcast the matches. That's where people get their first access to it, particularly people coming to the games for the first time.
Right.
And to see those in high definition is a huge part of that. Once people then get an interest into it, because Sky have only got 14 games, and we have over 100 games that we want to stream live across the world. So you need people to get an interest in it and then see that the streaming service is where we want gravitate.
You think they'll do promoing?
For the streaming service?
Yeah.
I think they probably react against that, but certainly it's the audience that comes will see that, listen, I want to see more, and where will I get more? And they get more in the joint venture with RTE.
Okay, let me come to you, Mick O'Keefe, on this. How did you take this?
Yeah, I suppose I heard about it last Friday, and I think one of the big issues for the GAA this week was that they were caught in the back foot, and it was leaked out before they could actually explain the context. My own view on it is you have to look at this in the wider context and look back at, you know, people are talking about Rubicons and thin ends of wedges this week.
And thick ends, and it is the wedge
and all that kind of stuff. But I think you have to look back over the last 25 years, and I think the GAA is walking this very fine tightrope of being a very important cultural and sporting organisation, of which, like RTE at times, and like the Catholic Church and other places where everyone seems to have a sense of ownership and a view on everything that they do. And you go back to 1991 when logos first went on the front of jerseys and people thought that was the end of the world.
The end of civilisation.
You know, you had Bank of Ireland and you'd Guinness pumping millions into promotion of the GAA, and people thought that was going to be the end of the world. You had the opening up of Croke Park, you had the multi-sponsor model, and so on, so on, so on. And for me, this is just another change. But, you know, the GAA is a very commercially driven, professionally run organisation. It happens to be that it's also a mass volunteer organisation and its players are amateurs. So you do have this kind of very tight balance that they have to get right. In my view, I think it's a good thing on balance. I do fully understand that and the view put out by the likes of Dr. Paul Rouse and Mark Duncan and those, and I do subscribe to some of what they're saying, is that pay-per-view TV does disenfranchise disproportionately younger people, older people and underprivileged. I think the counter arguments to that are stronger insofar as the reach that this will give the GAA in the UK, in that it is only 14 matches out of over 100 games that are shown live on TV every year, and it isn't the thin end of the wedge. I don't think this was purely commercially driven by the GAA. I think it was a promotional decision made to bring the games to a wider audience.
Is that it, that you didn't get the story out right at the beginning?
Well, I think it was unfortunate that Primetime went to show on Tuesday because we hadn't any deal signed. We signed our deal with RTE at 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and we still had issues all Tuesday afternoon to try and resolve, Marion. So it's not that we didn't get the story out. We had no story to get out because...
Funnily enough, I was reading the coverage last night and I saw reference to it, and I looked back at it, at the whole programme. But GAA was very well represented there.
I think, Marion, on that, I think one of the issues was that And it's covered extensively in the back of the Sunday Independent today by Eamon Sweeney, who's a very good kind of finger on the pulse in terms of GAA. Yeah. And, you know, I think RT in some places got it slightly wrong. And I think I fully take your point on Primetime. I spoke to people about this. There was more people in favour than not in favour who were actually interviewed.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were given an opportunity to talk. I just think it was the tone of the interview that Dave McCullough had with Porrig Duffy, where it was more a series of accusations rather than a
but
questions.
Nobody like, I mean, you can't do something like that without putting the other side, or you'd be shot.
Oh no, I fully agree with you. But I think, you know, Sweeney says McCullough's interrogation of Duffy was obviously a satirical dig at RT's normal practice of kowtowing to people in authority and letting away with all kinds of bullshit. That's what he says. Now, I don't subscribe. I think there's a wider issue here with RT, and I think RT, like a lot of media outlets, has been through a fairly bruising couple of years, and I think this was seen as a kind of another chip away at RTE. And I think RTE is nothing to be afraid of here. RTE's GA coverage is absolutely brilliant. We do an analysis in our company every Monday of what people are talking about online. And out of the five things that we shortlist, hashtag GA, hashtag Sunday Game, every Monday, the Sunday Game is nothing to be afraid of, and GA have nothing to be afraid of with this. They will. A competition is good for RTE, in my opinion.
Fiona Looney?
Yeah, it's extraordinary, actually. I was in London during the week, and this story was kind of breaking when I was going to London. And by the time I got back 2 days later, if you pardon the lazy pun, the sky had fallen in. And I was astonished by the reaction to this. You know, and I mean, I'm a member of the GAA. I have no problem with this Sky deal. I was never asked about black cards or anything else. I didn't need to be asked about this. But like the language. I mean, I'm looking at Pat Spillane in the Sunday World today. And, you know, he's using phrases like taking the Sky shilling, you know, getting into bed with Sky. The GAA has sold its soul for 30 pieces of silver. It's so emotive. And I think, you know, from a media point of view, it's a fascinating story that, as Mick said, we all feel we have a bit of ownership of the GAA and the way it's developed. But look, you know, again, like as Mick said, RTE has absolutely nothing to be afraid of. I mean, if there is a victim in all this, leaving aside the pensioner down the Boreen who can always listen to the games on the radio or go to the pub, the real victim, if there is a victim, is poor TV3, because, you know, they have really lost out. And I thought they did. I thought their coverage was very good over the last couple of years. I enjoyed it very much.
Was it to do with HD?
That would be a lot of it. And the fact that they only had a 26 county distribution, Marion. You know, I must say, I thought TV3 were very gracious in the whole process. We'd have a very, very strong relationship.
Matt Cooper writing about it today and wishing everybody well about it. May Hannafin.
It's better to go to see the match if you can, kind of girl, you know, and in a typical schizophrenic kind of way, I'm a Tipperary hurler and a Dublin footballer. But it just came to light really last Sunday. I mean, I went with my nephew to the Tipperary Cork League quarter final in Thurles, which is absolutely fantastic. But my parents were able to watch it on TG Cahir on television. So, I mean, that kind of combined the best of it. And really just 3 points I think I'd like to make. I'm very conscious over the last couple of years the way the GAA have moved from drink sponsorship into finding all other types of sponsorship. And they've had a lot of pressure on them to do that. So obviously they have to look at other sources for money. And even though they're talking about this being the diaspora, other commentators today say, no, it's nothing to do with the diaspora. This is a financial deal. So let's talk about it for what it is. But having said that, I think reaching out to the diaspora is actually a very noble thing to do as well. I'm actually doing a thesis on the Irish diaspora at the moment myself. And there's no doubt that the GAA is very strong and is a way of bringing Irish people together around the world. So it is good to do that, but that's not the main reason behind it. But the other thing as well is the very same arguments were made about the Heineken Cup and the rugby. And that actually, even though it is a pay-to-view, has hugely increased the interest in rugby amongst young people playing.
It has, but I was looking at the figures in one of the articles today, and I mean, the Heineken Cup is terrifically successful, but viewership through television of the Heineken Cup has gone way down.
I mean, when I was Minister for Sport, I mean, the argument came up about the free-to-air of the rugby games and the Heineken Cup. And the IRFU made a very, very strong argument that they were going to lose millions, in fact. And I supported them on it and was happy to support them on it because they are reinvesting the money, not only into the Aviva Stadium, but back into stadium all over the country and into the playing. And that's what the GAA now has to show that it's going to do, that it's going to continue to use this money back into the smaller towns, the smaller clubs and into promoting the game. game.
Declan Bauer?
Yeah,
I'll go back to you in a moment.
I quite agree with what Mary is saying and what was said earlier, in that I think the correspondents have shown themselves, maybe because they're absorbed in the minutiae, to be out of touch with what the ordinary GAA fan is thinking about this. And just as I was listening to the comments, I was thinking in terms of guys I grew up with who went abroad who were very keen GAA fans. One in particular, a close friend of mine, Gordon Carey, is a stalwart, and just using him as an example, a stalwart member of Shandona GAA outside Mullingar, spent most of his working life in England, was intimate attached to the GAA, comes back with his family, settles down, and then is injected into the heart of the club. And, you know, when he was abroad, to have got access through satellite channels to be able to keep up with what was happening. And for another friend of ours now who's down in Australia, Joe King, he can pay attention to this. Their sense of connection to their culture through sport and their families will be copper faceted. Yeah. So I think the GAA, I think it's full marks to them. And why shouldn't they pull together a good financial plan these days?
I think people were shocked initially, kind of, because there's a clash of ethos or something, as between what Sky appears to represent and what the GAA appears to represent.
I wonder, though, if it's a little bit of xenophobia as well. You know, I mean, like the big kind of unspoken thing is that Sky is a British channel. And I think that a lot of people have focused on the whole pay-per-view thing. But there is an underlying thing that, you know, are we just a little bit uncomfortable because the Irish Republican GAA has
gone to the
Brits?
And the other thing is that it might be the Murdoch factor, that people feel a bit queasy.
I agree with that, Marion. I think there's been, you're talking about the language that's been used, like the language been used around Sky is almost like it's some kind of cancer that's going to come in and grow and overtake the whole organisation. And I think there has been a little bit of anti-Sky, anti-British commentary in here. I think you said it's financially driven. I'm not so sure. I think if you look at it's estimated to be 10 million out of 55 million, which is the GAA turnover. It's not so all encompassing as maybe it would be for a professional sport like rugby, where the broadcast rights are hugely essential to pay the players to play. And I don't think this is going to lead to pay for play
either. Okay, can I just introduce Mark Duncan, who has joined us? He's co-author of the GAA People's History and a member, of course, of the GAA yourself. I don't know if you've seen the coverage this morning and what your take on it is.
Well, I've seen some of it, and obviously I've followed it during the week. Yeah. And as regards the panel here, I hate to be the fly in the ointment, because I would take a completely different interpretation on what's happened this week. And I think for good reason. I don't think there's any doubt there's large numbers of the GAA membership who will welcome this deal, who will be excited by any shake-up in coverage and any change. There'll be many more who won't care less. They'll just shrug and get on with things. But there will be a large body of opinion who will be deeply uneasy at this shift towards a pay TV model, the known effects of which not only jar, but are deeply inimical to the ethos of the GAA, to the values which it professes to hold dear. And those values emphasise, you know, inclusivity, access, participation, community, you know. And the GAA has a raft of initiatives and programmes, many of them well trumpeted, and they're fantastic programmes, you know, which really drive that home. You know, everything from its alcohol and substance abuse programme, which shows how socially aware they are, everything from its respect initiatives, its initiatives up the north by the Ulster Council and broadening access to unionist community. Everywhere you look, you see this really generous and broad and inclusive vision of an association. And here we have now struck a television deal which basically divides that community, and which divides them into those who
I
can
I don't think it divides the community, Mark.
Well, Peter, it absolutely does, because...
No, you're no rational sense of making that comment.
Well, have you looked at the research which is published? Did you look at the research at the impact of pay TV on sport in Ireland and internationally?
Tremendous feedback from the GAA members all over the world to say this is a very, very positive development. They're really, really pleased with the joint venture initiative that we have at RTE. And in this argument, you know, we haven't really focused in on TG Carr. They are taking 62 live games, 22 deferred. All of the highlights are still free to air. All radio programs are still free to air. We are giving an unprecedented blanket coverage to our games, to everybody that lives in the country. And I think, you know, change is disruptive. Absolutely is disruptive. I think, you know, let's see how this goes. This is a small nudge in a direction. This is not a cataclysmic change that's been painted. And let's see what comes back from it.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's small. I think, obviously, and I don't doubt that this is a good deal for Irish emigrants. I think the deal with that's going to be rolled out with RTÉ Digital is hugely progressive and hugely beneficial to Irish immigrants, you know. I think where people will have an opposition to it, and it's nothing to do with an opposition to Sky or any sort of kind of insecurity about Rupert Murdoch. It is just that they find it absolutely incompatible to have a pay TV model for your championship games. And it's not a small amount, Peter. It is just under a third of all your championship fixtures. TV3 have been cleared out of the game on this issue. And I think it's important to note that TV3 not only have a presence here, they have a news presence here with daily and evening news bulletins.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I really don't know what the incentive they're going to have to cover the GAA affairs after this sort of development. So the deal
no
wasn't...
Well, they will continue professionally. I mean, that's what they'll do.
But there is no... I've yet to hear a sound rationale for this move. There's been some talk about the internationalisation, exposure
yes.
of the games. But to what end? But to what end? Exposure is certainly not the same as development. You know, the history of sport everywhere in the world shows that you need a solid infrastructure. It's driven by missionaries. There's a reason why after 130 years, you know, the only places where the GAA has really spread and found any sort of solid foundation is among the Irish diaspora community. They're being catered for in this deal. You know, if we're looking beyond that, you know, if we're looking at a community beyond that, the non-Irish community, and I would love to see everybody seeing our games and enjoying our games. I have no difficulty with any of that. But if we're seriously talking about that, we need a much deeper and wide-ranging debate within the GAA as to what that involves. Where are we going to target? You know, what resources are we going to put in?
In what sense?
Well, if you want to put it this way, if we're hoping to develop the hurling abroad,
yeah.
everyone's talked about kind of how wonderful last year's All-Ireland final is. If after 130 years we've failed to develop hurling significantly in Monaghan and Mayo, what chance have we in the outer reaches of Massachusetts or Mumbai? You know?
Yeah.
Who would have thought you'd have a successful Dublin hurling team, and you do?
But there's a reason for that, Mary. We've put substantial amount of resources in it. And I don't question for a minute.
But as an organisation, Mark,
this year we put
44 million into reinvested back into the organisation. That's in a turnover of 55. That's an 82% recycling of all the funds that come through. The point that Mary made, we responded very, very positive to government indication and government direction on alcohol sponsorship, and we removed our sponsorship with alcohol companies. You know, we see ourselves as being extraordinarily progressive. Now, that money, you know, 14 million, 15 million goes through games development. We employ games development officers throughout the country. There's over 100 employed in that. There's 10 million that goes into capital development plans. So if you go around any place, you'll see 3G pitches, floodlights, clubhouses. The facilities that we have in play are second to none. And we're immensely proud of it. And I think it is, we do have an obligation to our members and followers and supporters who live in New York, who live in Shanghai, who live in Australia, to actually get these signals. And it's not free to air in a sense that we will have to invest heavily with RTÉ on a joint venture. We will have to invest heavily to get a signal from Montrose to Australia to get on the Channel 7 network. So all of this is about repositioning ourselves with a wider take, a global strategy as to what our games are about.
What is the global strategy?
It really hasn't been articulated in any sense this week, and maybe it would be nice to know what it is. It certainly hasn't been debated at a large level.
What is the global strategy?
Well, I think, Marion, if you have teams playing and practicing, you know, whether it's in Boston or New York or London or whatever, they deserve to see the best of the games being played by the intercounty teams on the best possible production platform, which is high definition. So we need companies that can carry that high definition signal into areas where people don't have to. They can see them locally.
Can I ask you a question? I mean, do you see as part of your vision that more people overseas will be playing the games?
Yeah, and it's growing. It's growing exponentially.
Is that part of?
It's a huge part of it, and we have an obligation to get signals out to those that diaspora. I mean, nobody willingly wants to leave the country, but emigration has been a large part of our history. So when communities set up, they want to have a feel for home, and a feel for home is really best expressed in Gaelic games.
Yeah, I'd agree just with Mark to a point in terms of, I think there is a split in opinion on this, and I don't think it's straightforward. I would say it's probably, from the people I've spoken, it's about 60-40 in favour, but it's still a sizable rump of people who are questioning it, and the right to question it. There's no issue at all with that. I think one of the, you know, there's a number of reasons why the GAA went down this route. One is obviously it has to safeguard its commercial future, and I've no issue at all with that. But it does always come back to this very fine tension between the ethos of the GAA and over-commercialisation of the GAA. I'm marginally in favour because I think it's only 14 matches. I don't think it's a thin end of the wedge that people talk about. I think one of the big reasons why GAA people are, in general, are supporting this is because Pádraig Duffy is a fantastic CEO of the GAA, and he's a guy that I think only has the betterment and of the GAA at heart. And I think if he's at the apex of the organisation, I think people will follow him. One of the other things that's been put forward is the production values that Sky might bring, as well as the exposure that it'll bring to the 3.5 million plus households in the UK, or 10 million depending on who you're talking to. I don't think people in Grimsby are going to pick up sticks and play hurling all of a sudden because it's on Sky Sports 3. However, it does give us more exposure. It makes sponsorship more valuable if you're going into more households, and I would welcome what kind of production value Sky will bring. If they can make Norwich away to Aston Villa in a nil all draw in January look like a good game, I'd be happy enough to see what they make Cavan away to Donegal in the first round of the Championship in Ballybuffet look like.
It should be said, it's not as if TV3 or RT are rolling up with black and white cameras, you know, and it's a fair point.
Could be very artistic.
We talk about small mindedness here and fear of the British.
I did say you were late to the table, Mark, and I did say that Sunday game would do a fantastic job.
I always thought the last thing we wanted people in Grimsby to start playing hurling. It's the only thing we're good at. We don't want other people to play it and beat us, for God's sake.
Mine, if you just say a minute, I've been looking at the Irish American organisations, and you know, for years, things like the county associations were terribly important to emigrants. They all kind of gravitated towards the Cork Association or the Tipperary. They're all dying on their feet because I suppose they've aged out, as it were. And one of the few Irish American organisations, or Irish organisations in America, that actually is successful is the GAA, because you have a new breed of young immigrants, unfortunately.
But sadly.
Unfortunately, as I said, they're well educated, they're fit, they're young people, they want to be involved. So it's a way for them to network and to be involved in a sport that they like and that they know. And I think this will genuinely actually support them in that work.
Do you think this will be brought up at Congress?
Oh, I think it will, yeah. We're a great organisation for robust debate, Mary.
I thought you told me.
I said there was none.
Sorry, excuse me, please. I thought you told me about 20 minutes ago that there was no robust debate, that there was harmony and agreement about this from day one.
But I think when it goes to the floor of Congress, the debate will be robust.
Well, I've no doubt about that. You would have anticipated, as has happened with all the other major changes, that there has been some sort of debate beforehand. I mean, Pádraig Duffy, as late as last year, was saying that this is something he really just couldn't bring to a management committee because it wouldn't pass. I'm really not sure what has changed since. And, you know, again, just some of the kind of caricaturing of some of the opposition to this, you know, as if you're somehow kind of backwards men, or, you know, that's not the case. I mean, Peter's quoted in the paper today as talking about the irrationality of some of the opposition. I don't think it's in any way irrational to kind of point to the kind of conflict between a pay TV model and the values the GAA professes. And in fairness, Christy Cooney, on another issue 3 years ago, he was very critical of elements within the GAA who profess values and failure to deliver on them. I don't see how, I see an absolute correlation between that that issue and this. And I don't think it's irrational either to point to the weight of Irish and international evidence, which shows the impact of television in reducing your audience and disenfranchising large groups. I don't think it's irrational to point to the fact that the GAA has, for the first time, sold exclusive rights for what they themselves have said is only a marginal increase. I don't think it's unreasonable to point out that when you say this is about exposure overseas, I don't think it's unreasonable to ask, what exactly are the aims and objectives of that strategy?
Well, we've just heard it's for Irish overseas.
Well, the Irish overseas have actually been catered for through the RTE digital agreement, so they're actually going to access the games. If it is to go beyond that, and I said, if we're talking about internationalisation, well, then what has been spoken of this week has been so vague as to be absolutely meaningless. And I think we need a much more serious discussion around that.
What people have forgotten here is that Satanta have been showing games on their UPC platform for a number of years now, quite successfully, which is in a kind of a subscription model as well. And this isn't the first time that GA games will be shown exclusively on a pay-per-view platform.
That's true.
It is different, and I appreciate that. The other thing that people are saying is that it should have been it should have been discussed at Congress, only to a point, because you can't discuss live commercial negotiations where there's four or five bidders at the table and throw it out to every single delegate from around the country and say, well, what do you guys think? And we have an open debate around whether we go with Sky on X million or TV3 on this, or have RT need to up their bid. Or you can't do that. You could discuss maybe the principle of a small proportion of games being shown on pay-per-view. And I wouldn't be opposed to that.
Again,
I wouldn't be opposed to that.
It's not a small proportion. I mean, there are two kind of new developments in this. One is hugely positive, which is the deal with RT Digital, which is actually going to stream all of these games and make them available across the world. The other one is the pay TV model, which we know is going to reduce audience at home. And for just under a third of our championship matches, up to and including our quarterfinals. So that is a significant departure, and it's worth pointing out.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out the headline too in Matt Cooper today. I thought he was very generous, given that he was involved in the coverage in 3v3, and he said, see how Sky plays it before sticking the boot into the GAA. Last word on this, Fiona?
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary to me that we've spent 35 minutes discussing this, because to me this is a back page story, a bottom page one story.
Well, now,
but
Fiona,
it's a
can I just
tell
you,
the scale of the
there's
GAA.
There's the Matt Cooper, GAA refused to sell foreigners. That's from the Sunday Times. GAA has sold its soul to Lion Murders. That's from the Sindo. Forward-looking and commercially astute decision from the Sindo. I mean,
the coverage is
not a back page story.
It just shows the unique role that the GAA holds,
that's
obviously, in Irish life.
Yeah.
And that's brilliant. And the GAA is very robust. And believe it or not, it will survive this.
Yeah, that was the point that Donal O'Cusack made in his article yesterday. Anyway, we will leave that topic there for the moment, and we will move on after a break. With us in studio, Peter McKenna, Fiona Looney, Mary Hannafin, Declan Power, Mick O'Keefe and Mark Duncan, who has a look about him that he's about to go. Thank you very much indeed, Mark. All the best.
1850 715 150.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, the other big story in the papers today, obviously, are the stories surrounding Alan Chatter and all that was involved in the story leading up to now. And Pat Lee, he's writing in the Business Post, the five questions that won't go away, which are: why the commissioner ended up resigning, why was Chatter not informed of the letter, why was Chatter not informed by the Taoiseach, why did the AG not tell government, Taoiseach or Chatter about the Garda bugging, and five, why was Eamon Gilmore not told? Actually, I think there are a few more than that as well. Mary Hannafin?
Pages and pages again, which I think must be very worrying for Minister Chatter, because this now is running on for a number of weeks. But I think the story seems to be just moving on, not away from him, but in a more damaging kind of a way almost, because the Sunday Independent and the Sunday Times both have editorials on it. And then there, you mentioned Pat Leahy and many other stories as well. But they seem to be saying that not only is there a lack of confidence in Alan Chatter now as minister, in his ability to run his department, but also now...
You wouldn't be biased in any way, would
no,
you?
And I'm genuinely now just questioning, reading what people are actually saying in the articles, because the coverage is something, certainly not back page stuff. But also the questioning, for example, the Sunday Independent editorial, the Taoiseach's own judgment is open to question. And that's coming up now as a theme in a couple of stories, because it's questioning why is the Taoiseach really backing a minister who also seems to be losing the confidence of his colleagues.
But they stood in chorus saying how highly they respect him and admire him as a minister.
That always happens at a vote of no confidence.
Is that right?
Always happens. You'll always rally behind because you're never going to give in to the opposition on it. It doesn't necessarily mean that the fall won't come at another stage. But a more serious question has also been raised.
But wasn't it a waste of space and dull time and public time to have the vote of no confidence when you know well in advance that it's going to be, that there wasn't a hope in hell of it being carried?
No, because it was the only way that the opposition could keep the issues on the floor of the Dáil, because obviously the government weren't going to do it. And because there are still so many questions to be answered in relation to...
But they didn't emerge, though, did they?
But it was important to keep them up front and to keep asking them. And the very fact that the opposition did it during the week is the reason that the media are doing it today.
Can I ask you a question in the relationship between a minister and a secretary general? Were you very surprised? Or were you as surprised as the public seemed to be and those writing the articles, that when the commissioner said that this was to be brought to the attention of the minister, that it wasn't?
I think it is absolutely incredible that a secretary general would receive a letter by hand from the Garda commissioner which said bring this to the immediate attention of the minister, and it's not done for over two weeks. I mean, I certainly don't want to go down the road of being accused of calling somebody a liar, but I do
But
I do not believe that that happened. I do not believe. Maybe he didn't see the letter, or as Brian Purcell says in his own statement, the minister received a copy of the actual letter. Using that word, actual letter. I wonder why did he use that
word? What
does
that mean
exactly?
Well, what are you implying?
Did he receive details of it? Did he receive briefing on it? Did he receive a copy note on it? Was there a memo sent to him on it?
He was pretty clear that he hadn't seen it.
He was very clear that he hadn't seen the letter. When Shane Ross asked him in the very early days if he had been briefed on the content of it, he didn't answer it. And I'm quite straight about this. The relationship between a minister and the Secretary General of a department is absolutely critical for the effective running of a department. All ministers, I'd say, would speak on a daily basis with the Secretary General. You certainly would have long conversations and briefings before a cabinet meeting. And yet, notwithstanding that, before a cabinet meeting, before a briefing, before the Garda commissioner was sacked, before
resigned,
any of this...
Resigned,
retired, before the commission of inquiry was going to be set up, the minister wasn't told and didn't know about it. So either he is incompetent or else there's other questions to be answered.
I too read that Pat Leahy piece and the five questions, and I think the big thing, there's a lot of questions that haven't been answered. And I think, as the Sunday Indo editorial goes, that shatters in a variant of political examinership, which is nicely put. But he's been taking the flak for all the ills of the government. There's been a number of opinion polls out this week which have shown a slip. And I think the question really is now, is he going to survive or not? And I think, you know, one of the, again, in the Sunday Indo analysis piece, talks about that if he does survive, well, then the ultimate sacrificial victim of all this might be the government itself. And I think that's where political expediency and political pragmatism may come in, that if it gets to a point that questions remain unanswered, and as Alistair Campbell says, I think there's a magical number of weeks that he talks about, if this story doesn't go away in the next week or two, I think then the government and the Kenny's going to be left with a very difficult decision to make.
Fiona?
Yeah, I mean, exactly as Mick says. I mean, it's astonishing that this story has rolled on now for as long as it has. And I think every fresh week we kind of think, oh, that's going away. And by the end of the week, everyone is talking about it again.
And then there are the two inquiries to come up. So that's going to bring it all up again.
Yeah, absolutely. And meanwhile, we have the details, which are all over the paper today, of what's come out in the Ian Bailey case, which, you know, obviously we're limited on what we can say about it. But extraordinary sort of side stories that are going along with this story. To me, at this stage, it's baffling that Shatter is still in office, because not just is he damaged beyond repair, but the government is suffering serious damage, as we've seen in polls over the last few days. Enda Kenny is suffering serious damage, and yet he's still there. He must have something extraordinary on the Taoiseach.
Well, it has to be said. It has to be said that with conviction, endless people have said that he's a fantastic minister.
Yeah,
and that
absolutely.
He is excellent at doing the job. So, I mean, you can understand why the Taoiseach might want to leave him there.
Yes, however, but this is a litany of errors, disasters. You know, as Mary said, the whole business of not seeing a letter for 15 days.
But if
it's
you
not
don't,
entirely credible.
But if you haven't seen it, if you didn't see it.
Well, you should have, because you're the minister. And
but if
you
somebody
know, should...
doesn't bring something to your attention...
Well, then that person
Marian,
should
wasn't
be gone.
He in Mexico, though, for most of this?
He only went to Mexico on the 10th. And on the 15th, I'm sorry. The letter came in on the 10th and he went on the 15th. But it wasn't any old letter. It was a letter from the Garda Commissioner at a time when there were serious issues between the department and the Garda Commissioner. And even if you don't just want to move outside of this particular letter, I mean, there is also the investigation into the GSOC bugging. There's the whole whistleblower dossier. There's the GSOC penalty points, the Commissioner of Investigation. There are very, very big issues that are going on. And I remember even when the Taoiseach stood up in defence of Alan Shatter, he pointed out all of the people who don't like him. The judiciary don't like him, the law society don't like him, the bar council don't like him. I'm not sure that's actually a badge of honour for a minister. Because
if you take that the Troika really wanted reform over what you presided over
and fees
for
and
decades, and they said that it needed changing, well, then you have to understand that somebody has to have the backbone to say to them, sorry, guys, we are going to reform, and you have to accept the fact that they may not like you for doing
that. True, but reform and change, absolutely welcome in all areas. The Troika were quite specific in relation to fees, and quite understand that. What has happened in conjunction with that, and the papers today talk about it, is a lack of confidence in the law and order system of this country. Now, that is something that no government can stand over.
Declan, I wanted to come to you on that in particular, because in the midst of the coverage and what's going to come out and what isn't going to come out and the tapes and the recordings and all of that, are the Gardaí very badly damaged? The whole of An Garda Síochána?
No, I think the management of An Garda Síochána as an entity have been damaged. And I think public confidence in the upper echelons of how the Garda Síochána go about their business, you know, that has been badly rattled. It's interesting. I think Minister Shatter's biggest problem is, in many respects, he's very much a maverick in Irish political life, and even within his own party. So as these things are coming out, nobody wants to see anything positive in his handling of it. I suppose, to be honest, in recent times there hasn't been much positive. But the fact that he isn't afraid to try and put manners on different institutions and elements in the further down the road doesn't always get the recognition that it should. The problem now is that there are issues, like I see that Philip Ryan in the Sunday Indo has a piece about that the Justice Department went to GSOC in June about their concerns about these illegal tapings. And this goes back to the point all the other speakers have been talking about. Why didn't he know? Why didn't he know? And what I would be thinking if I was the minister in my defence is I would want to show the paper trail. Because and Mary, you would know this more than anybody, there is, in these circles, a very straightforward type of paper trail about of documents that have to go to a minister. So where did it stop short? I mean, Minister Shatter and his...
Also the coincidence of a bereavement.
Indeed, but nevertheless, you know, if it was something serious... So what this boils down to, either this document, the information from this document, was put in front of the eyes of the minister at some point and he dropped the ball because it didn't stick in his head, or he put it to one side and said, I'll deal with it later, which I'm sure can happen, or that it didn't get put in front of him when it should have been. Now, the one thing is, even if it did get put in front of him, and he forgot about it, just we'll assume that for a second, you would think, wouldn't you, that with the recent numbers of, you know, the recent debacles, that this would come shoot up from the back of his mind and think, you know, I want to be watching my six o'clock on that. And he doesn't appear to have been. So I find it very strange, the whole provenance of that document. Its journey, we'll say, through the department and ultimately to his desk or not, as the case may be.
Yeah,
can I come to you on it, if I may, Peter McGinnis, since you ran a very large organisation yourself, and I see Michael Smurf getting a lot of coverage today too. What's your take on both the coverage and what happened? I mean, in the middle of all this, the commissioner is gone, and that seems to have been forgotten too.
Yeah, I think the Commissioner Callaghan was, to my mind, any dealings that we had with him, he's an exceptionally nice person, and I think he was he really is the casualty of this whole affair. I take your point that, you know, Minister Shatter was in Mexico, there was a bereavement, and maybe the letter did skip. It seems to be a very, very heavy price to pay to seek for resignation on days seeing a letter. I think there's a whole thing about, you know, you get emails and people are demanding responses almost instantaneously. And I don't know how your own inboxes are, fellas, but I know... awful. 60, 70, 80 emails a day.
You could spend your entire life answering emails.
You really could, you know. Yeah. I mean, you wonder, are you actually being...
productive.
Productive in what you're doing. I mean, I think sometimes obeying for a resignation probably won't get the interrogation of the system that probably needs to be done.
I definitely think the focus this week in today's papers, the knives have been sharpened. And I think, you know, one of two things that strike me, the first one is that, you know, people far better informed than I am on this particular issue would say that he has done a lot of good in terms of reform and so forth, but he tends to have a style that's quite stubborn and belligerent. And I think that style that may have helped him to get through reforms.
But
maybe the one thing that he might fall in his own
sword. Isn't the substance more important than the style?
It is, but there's a bigger issue here as well. And I'm friendly with a number of people who work in the police force. And morale is on the floor at the moment in the police force, if you talk to anybody. And I think that's no good to anyone at the moment. And you talk to senior Gardaí and junior Gardaí, etc. And they are looking for a way out of the fog at the moment. And I don't think this is helpful.
Yeah, that's what I was asking Declan. But you think that in the round they haven't?
How do you mean?
They haven't. In terms of respect and trust and confidence and all of that from the plain people of Ireland.
Now, I think the day-to-day, the ordinary people and the relationship with Gardaí on the ground, I think, is still intact. I mean, you know... there will be issues about maybe how things are being handled, as I said, at an operational. I think the Gardaí themselves, though this is not something that is new, I think middle to junior ranking Gardaí have been gradually losing confidence in the upper echelons for some time, long before this. They feel that resources haven't been addressed, that senior ranks, sometimes to get to be a senior rank in the way the Gardaí has been structured since the foundation of the state, you've got to be politically astute. I don't mean hobnobbing with political parties. You've got to be a political animal in how you negotiate the upper ranks.
And you don't criticise them.
And you don't maybe nail your colours to the mast about the fact that there aren't enough serviceable squad cars in the division that you're in command of, in a way that maybe... senior ranks in other institutions might do so, because you know that's going to affect your promotional prospects. And I think that the chickens have come home to roost about that, and there's been a growing disjoint, and this is just illustrating it a little bit more. And I think that this is ample opportunity now for this state to examine the nature of how the management classes in the Gardaí are created, you know, the officer class of the Gardaí, how they go about their business, and how they're groomed, how they're selected. If we look across the water, the various British constabularies have set in place different kinds of systems to identify people at a junior level that are suitable for senior management, and they groom them, they give them opportunity to get experience in different sections, and so by the time they get along up to becoming, we say, a commander of the Metropolitan Police or a chief superintendent, they're at a younger age, they have a broader experience, and there maybe is, dare I say it, a little bit more vibrancy. And I think a lot of younger Gardaí, who for the most part are very well educated, experienced, keen on their careers, don't often get the chance to move up fast enough at the right time where they can make that difference. Maybe this is something that we can take something positive out of this.
I hope that the government then genuinely don't sap the morale of the force altogether by saying that not one of the 13,000 of you is suitable to be the Garda Commissioner.
Yeah.
Obviously the best person for the job should get it, but I hope they don't take an automatic decision that we're going to look outside, because I really think that would undermine the force terribly. And I also think, I also just wonder, does Minister Shatter now have the authority to be able to oversee any of the reform that he wants to bring in?
The issue of the confidence in the Gardaí, there was an interesting poll in the Irish Times yesterday where they asked whose reputation has been damaged by all this.
Yes.
And pretty much everybody's reputation, apart, very interestingly, from the rank and file Gardaí, in which there has been no change in public confidence. So, you know, I suppose that is reassuring that the people who are not involved in this really, you know, are... hopefully, you know, above it in terms of public confidence.
Right. OK, we'll leave that one there for the moment. The other stories getting a lot of coverage today are rehab and what is or isn't going to happen at the pack and so on and so forth, and who's going to go and who isn't going to go. Your own view on that? What do you think of the performance of the pack at the moment, May Anthony?
Certainly come into its own. And I think probably because the government have such a majority in the Dáil, that the Dáil chamber is ineffective, that the committees now have been shown to be quite strong and influential, and the PAC particularly. Can't say the same for the Justice Committee, though, which is a pity, because I think the Justice Committee has a role to play on all of the last topic, but they're not coming up to the plate on it. But certainly the PAC is. Sometimes I worry just looking at the PAC, and they've got the results. Is it very bullying? And bullying of private citizens as well. You know, I know they'll look back and they say, oh, we got him and we got her. But that's probably just a tone and an attitude thing. But having said that, the PAC is a very important stall committee. And I do think if people are invited to appear before, they should go. And particularly in
mind
the context
you, with
of the
amount of scalps that have got, you wouldn't be looking for an invitation, would you?
It's very aggressive. And I think you would feel threatened as an ordinary
Peter?
Private citizen there.
I think the PSCT committee has done a tremendous job. I think the damage from rehab, not talking about the personalities, is the impact it's had on charity collection across the country. And I think that is a terrible legacy, that people feel that if they are contributing to charities, that money is not going to where it's needed. And I think that's an area that needs a radical overhaul. And I think it's hugely important that that happens quickly, because the work of charities in the country is tremendous. And we'd all wish that they didn't have to be there, but they do have to be there.
I think that's a good point, or worth remembering too, that even if PAC maybe need to moderate their tones sometimes, that the real people at fault here were the leadership in those charities. If the buckets are dwindling, the amounts of money in them are dwindling, it's because they wouldn't come to the fore and be straightforward and honest. Wasn't that long ago somebody was being asked on RT, they weren't an organisation that had the finger pointed at them, but when they were asked, how much is your chief executive earn? Oh, well, that's not something we disclose. What, you're not the CIA and you're getting public money. They're getting, the chickens have come home to roost.
We represent a number of charities, and there's a wider issue around kind of morale in those in that sector as well. And I think there has been a very damaging blow to the charity sector.
I mean, the recession initially, and then this.
Absolutely, and you know, I think in the CRC and in rehab, when you look at those two in focus, I think there's a different element, even outside of the lack of transparency of very poor governance as well. That doesn't do the sector any favours whatsoever. I think from a PR perspective, I think rehab have kind of waddled into this through their, you know, they're trying to manipulate Morning Ireland with an 8:27 a.m. interview with only getting two questions before a break to the 8:30 news. And
my
no discussion,
goodness, nobody would ever
no discussion
be that
around salary. And I think,
my
I know, God, but I think it's but I think I that's my job. I think I think it kind of rumbled on, and like, you know, any, you know, you would have thought that early on she could have grasped the nettle and said, OK, here's my salary, this is what's happening, it's up for review, and it may have moved on. But the fact that she let it rumble for 5 or 6 or 7 weeks, I think, yeah.
Right, OK, one other thing that I've been asked to ask you about, and I meant to do it earlier on, Peter, Garth Brooks.
He's a great customer.
Have you tickets? Tickets for every one of the audience. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, he's very popular. The tickets were sold in jig time and all that. It's tough on the people that live around there. I thought the deal was that there would only be 3 per annum, big shows in Croke Park.
We have planning permission for 3 concerts, but in every other concert that we go for under licence. But that would be the pattern across the city. So, you know, concerts in the Phoenix Park are done by licence, and the RDS and the Aviva, they're done by licence. But certainly 5 consecutive concerts will have an impact on the area. We're working now closely with Kieran Mulvey. We're engaging with the local community to see how best we can ameliorate that issue.
Listen, talking to them after the event doesn't change the fact that for 5 days they're going to be imprisoned, so to speak, or nights, I suppose.
See, I wouldn't disagree with you entirely there, Maren, because the way the licensing legislation is set up is you go for a licence after you've announced the event. I really think that we need to look at the Planning Development Act there and look that you need to get a licence first before you then go and sell tickets. So we are in a competitive space, so we didn't have any concerts last year, for example, and So this year, yeah, we're successful. We have One Direction and we have Garth Brooks. I would say, though, that fundamentally we need in the city to look that licences should be applied for first.
Before the tickets are sold.
The tickets go,
because,
inside.
I mean, by the time the first spokespeople came out for the residents, all the tickets were gone. The horse was long gone.
The horse was long gone, and I think that's an anomaly in the legislation. So I think that's something
but
that
But you drove a coach and four through it, didn't you?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I think that's the it's the way I mean, it's a country and western singer, so the level of disruption, it's not like it's a big rock band. It's not going to give the level of noise and disruption. Respectability in music is probably not
it's
my
like
forte.
The Swedish House Mafia are coming to play in town for five nights. No, but there was a guy during the week said that Garth Brooks is going to lend Croke Park to the Dubs in July or whatever it is on. But no, I think it's one of those things. With Croke Park is now a big venue as well as being the home of the GEA. And I think, again, we talk about the balance in the GEA and Croke Park and what is the right number. I think the GEA will learn a lot out of this particular process and it'll probably
guide. So will the local residents.
Yeah.
They will, Mary. But there's a massive boost to the economy. I mean, these concerts do bring, you know, the best part of £250,000 into Dublin City. And that is huge. 40% of all the people who are engaged in Croke Park are hired locally. So it's a big boost to the local economy. So they are, you know, when we get a gathering together and we push people, 70,000 people come to Garth Brooks are coming from around the world.
You're justifying
the city needs to be open.
It.
I am indeed, but I also would say at the same time that we've got to be very, very respectful of the local community and, you know.
But it's not respectful to inform them after the event. I mean, there was nothing they could do about it, was there? If all the blooming tickets were sold, well, what do you do? Send the money back and say, sorry,
we've the reaction.
Huh?
Did you see the other thing?
We'd be bidding for a concert like that against all the other venues in the city. So commercially sensitive information like that can't go out. And that's why I think you should absolutely have to go for a licence or event before you sell
right.
tickets.
Did you see that the One Direction concert was on the same day as the European and local elections? So I was reading a story where in Mayo they want to delay the train in the morning so that people can vote before they actually come up.
You can't vote if you're 14, though.
No, what made me laugh was they were talking about getting the 5:15 train from Westport or the 7 a.m. train. I don't know any teenager in the country who will get up at 7 a.m. to go to a concert.
Well, they might get up at 7 a.m. to go to a match. What match are you going to today, Fiona?
Well, I'm actually, I'm no longer going to OMA because I don't need to go to OMA now for Dublin Tyrone. So when I finish here, I'll be going to the under-15 St Jude's against Ballyboden up in Tymon Park.
And you?
Where I'm off you? To Wexford Park, Marion, as I'm Wexford Longford, and it's a Division 3 relegation playoff. So hopefully Longford come through.
Okay, well, anyway, listen, we've just come up to 12 noon, and I have to go to the newsroom and Clodagh Walsh.